WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV with your host, Rebecca Terrell. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. It's Friday, March 10th. I'm Paul Dragoo, and today we're dedicating the entire news segment to one very important topic. So President Joe Biden is expected to use his presidential veto pen for the first time. His target is a bill that Congress recently passed that would nix his promotion of woke ESG measurements for 401k retirement investments. ESG stands for Environmental Social Governance. It pressures private companies to adopt left-wing policies on climate change and so-called social justice issues related to gun control, abortion, LGBTQ equity, and critical race theory. ESG isn't an issue that the public is very familiar with. And speaking of CRT, some mainstream media organs are accusing conservatives of trying to turn ESG into the new CRT. And it doesn't look like they're totally wrong. Here's U.S. Representative Andy Barr, a Kentucky Republican, on the congressional floor a couple weeks ago, passionately condemning the ESG scheme.
This is not material for the vast majority of Americans. The studies show that most Americans don't even know what ESG is. And to the extent Americans do find it material, nothing in this resolution prohibits an American from allocating their capital the way they want to. But what this resolution will do is stop the Department of Labor from coercing Americans into lower performing, higher fee, less diversified, politicized funds. We must stop the politicization of allocation of capital. And when my friend from Illinois says, well, why are Republicans picking losers? Really? Really? In 2022, the S&P 500 energy sector ended the year a whopping 59% higher than where it started, amid a brutal bear market in which the S&P 500 overall lost 20%. If you are invested in ESG in 2022, you are a massive loser because you are divested from energy.
Barr has co-sponsored a House resolution that would overturn a Biden administration Labor Department rule regarding ESG investment. The resolution passed Congress with help from Democrats like Joe Manchin and John Tester. But, as we already mentioned, Biden is expected to veto it. Although it has only hit the general public's radar in the past year or so, ESG, like most globalist schemes, has been quietly in the works for decades. The foundation for ESG was laid more than 30 years ago by the Business Council for Sustainable Development at the 1992 Earth Summit, a defining event when the globalists unveiled Agenda 21, a program for implementing a global government. The New American Magazine attended and reported on the event, and its parent company, the John Birch Society, has been pushing back on Agenda 21 schemes for more than a decade. The next major step came in 1999, when then United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan went to the World Economic Forum's annual Davos extravaganza to announce the UN's Global Compact, which served as a means to promote responsible business practices and UN values among the global business community. It claimed the support of thousands of companies, business executives, and stakeholders. Then in 2000, the UN held its Millennium Summit in New York City, which yielded the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. The goal of the MDGs was to implement the UN's Agenda 21 piecemeal. And then more woke corporatists signed on to the MDGs, which were supposed to bring about global nirvana by 2015. But when 2015 came along, the World Economic Forum globalists replaced the 8 MDGs with the 17 SDGs, or Sustainable Development Goals. Okay, so here's the truth about ESG. It's responsible for less investing in oil and gas industries, and you can thank it for the high gasoline prices you're paying. ESG is the reason Major League Baseball pulled the All-Star Game out of Atlanta in 2021 after the state passed a rather benign election integrity law. ESG is propelling the aggressive yet illogical electric vehicle campaign. And ESG supports today's nonsensical race narratives. In a nutshell, ESG is woke corporatism. Supporters, however, and unsurprisingly, say otherwise. They say that ESG isn't about boycotting specific industries or companies, but about doing a better job assessing future risks. They argue that considering those factors is a part of an investment manager's obligation to get the best returns possible. Asset fund managers BlackRock and Vanguard have been two financial behemoths leveraging their massive influence to push ESG. BlackRock has an outside footprint in the Biden administration, with former top executives of the firm in key Biden posts. But now that the people are awakening to the consequences of ESG, these asset managers are beginning to feel the pinch. BlackRock recently reported it lost $4 billion thanks to political backlash against ESG. And in December, Vanguard resigned from the Net Zero Managers Initiative, a coalition of 301 asset managers committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Vanguard CEO said ESG investing, quote, does not have any advantage over broad-based investing. That's a diplomatic way of saying we're losing money with a scheme. The Financial Times reported that the decision from the coalition has further irritated environmental activists, who are already mad because Vanguard had refused to completely rule out fossil fuels investment. And joining me to discuss this topic is longtime editor-in-chief of the New American magazine, Gary Benoit. Hey, Gary.
Hey.
Those environmentalists, they're always mad about something, huh, Gary?
Boy, no kidding about that. But of course, their cause is a fake cause.
Yeah,
let's... Because we're really not destroying the planet.
Right. You've been at the helm of this magazine, and we've been reporting for such a long time. And it's important. Why don't you explain how... All these standards, these ESG standards, the first and biggest problem is that they're bunk narratives, right? At least for the most
absolutely.
Part.
Absolutely. And climate change is just an example. But if you don't mind, Paul, let's spend a moment and talk about climate change specifically. Because I'm old enough where I remember going back to my high school days, the original Earth Day, which was called then the environmental teach-in. And at that time... The big climate crisis that they were talking about was not global warming. It was global cooling. We were supposedly going into a new ice age, and of course that did not materialize. And then years later, they started talking about global warming. And they've been talking about global warming in terms of runaway global warming, in terms of catastrophic global warming.
Yeah.
That we can now look at the predictions that were made years ago and compare it to today. Because
but you have, right?
Right. And we have. We covered that in the New American magazine and have reprinted some of the quotes as to what people such as Al Gore had to say about the ice caps melting and that sort of thing. But it did not happen. And, of course, if we fast forward to today, in recent years, the global warming has disappeared. In recent years... The global temperature has not gone up, even according to the government's own data. And it's important to contrast with that with the fact that the theory of runaway global warming is not simply that the temperature is going to go up on average a certain amount every year, but it's going to be, once again, run away. In other words, it's going to get progressively worse and be going up faster and faster, and that simply has not happened. But unfortunately, many Americans, particularly young Americans, have been beguiled regarding this.
Yeah.
And so they think we have to take drastic measures in order to save the planet.
Yeah.
And those drastic measures basically include shutting down our civilization that we have today, which is powered by energy, to basically scrap fossil fuels, for instance, to get rid of energy and to live a more sustainable lifestyle. Which translated means to get rid of suburban housing that we have today, to get rid of the private automobile and so forth.
Yeah.
And so even though the cause that is being championed by the global warming alarmists is a cause that they say is to save the planet,
It's
really not about saving the planet. It's about shackling the planet.
Well, one of their main points is that when people like us say these things, they're like, wow, there's a consensus, and you guys are a bunch of wackos. And I wanted to touch slightly on, I believe later in the segment, we're actually going to have an interview with an expert on this. But
yes.
This consensus, that's another part of the propaganda scheme, and as we'll see later in the segment, but also that we've learned, including from Dr. Stephen Koonin, who used to work for under the Obama administration, what we're learning is that this consensus is like it was during COVID. It's one of those deals where they shut everyone else out. They don't give grants. They you know, it's suicide for these experts to say anything about it. So what happens is, yeah, they're going to be quiet. There's going to be consensus because it doesn't pay to speak out, to say, well, look, they're really, the data is not clear. And like I said, Stephen Koonin said this in his interview with Joe Rogan. We have an interview coming up with that in another segment with scientists in the field saying there really isn't a consensus, or at least there's lots more scientists that we know of who are saying this is not the case. But if we say anything, our careers are doomed, or we may not get grants or anything like that.
Yet there are still scientists who are speaking out. And as you say, we will have one later in the program.
Absolutely. Another narrative that is bunk is this whole racial violence, right. Gun violence. I read a 2021 Manhattan Institute study that was really interesting because what it showed was that the construction is based on big tech and medias and people who are, and ideological, it's politically ideological. So for instance, one of the studies that showed was that people who are either Democrats and or more, you know, on social media, they're more likely to believe that there's more racism. They're also, you know, they did questions like some folks think that, you know, black folks are more likely to get shot by a cop than they are to die in a car accident, which of course is not true.
Oh, that's absolute nonsense.
Yeah, so that's another part of the narrative that ESG is pushing.
Right.
Is there any narrative of ESG that's even close to true?
I have to stop and think about that, but I'd like to go back, Paul, to what you were talking about with regard to the racial issue and specifically critical race theory. Mm. It's really designed, I think, to divide this country, to get kids, because they're getting this in the schools. They're getting it, in fact, at the elementary level. But to try to get kids who otherwise would not think about race to think about race, and, of course, black Americans are told constantly that they're the victims of racism, that there's systemic racism in this country. And it's very, very harmful to the country. And it's outrageous that, through investments and 401k, that the government by executive order would try to impose its will on how funds are invested to get money to go into companies that support ESG.
Yeah.
Instead of doing what is in the best interest of the investors, which, of course, would be to make a profit, right?
Right.
But to get them to support these social causes.
Well, it looks like they're waking up. And obviously, we're not in that realm. At least, I'm not. I don't know, if you are. But how did they not see this coming? I guess that's what really really gets me is they're like, oh, we're seeing the numbers and they're not lining up. And thank goodness that there's backlash. But it's like,
right.
These are narratives that I would think that most Americans don't believe. The other issue was the LGBTQ equity,
Right. That's so-called equity.
Yeah, so-called equity.
Right. There's sometimes it's referred to as diversity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the problem is that they don't want tolerance. They want celebration. They want to bully us into that, right?
Well, they want to condition the American people to accept and then embrace a lifestyle that is perverse.
Right.
Because what we're talking about is abnormal sexual activity with regard to things such as homosexuality. And, of course, with transgenderism, we're talking about a disorder. Because we're talking about people who have been convinced to believe as a result of the culture in which we live that you can identify as a member of the opposite sex. And
is that?
Yeah, it really is.
And
it's so destructive because when you look at the kids who have accepted this and they consider themselves transgender, the suicide rate just skyrockets. And so they're really not happy. If they were, they'd be committing suicide. And I think this is because they're torn, because a boy really is a boy, a girl really is a girl. And when you think you're a boy trapped in a girl's body or vice versa, I mean, just imagine the mental anguish that must cause.
I had Dennis on, the publisher of The New American, mm-hmm. yesterday, and we spent quite a bit of time on this. And, you know, he'd written an entire book, and part of it was what this is really about. It's about obliterating God's design for humanity, for life. So, you know, first you eradicate sex.
Yes.
You know, we refer to that instead of gender. You eradicate that, and then you move on to what most people don't have any idea this is happening. I would not think that's necessarily the case with the New American readers and viewers. And, you know, I've talked to my pastor about it here and there, and mm-hmm. he's never heard about it, and he's pretty in tune. But, you know, his response was something to the degree, like, well, this makes sense. But that's what this is really about. But unfortunately, it's causing so much carnage.
Right.
So much carnage, because, like I said yesterday, and it's... that should be one of the first signs that this is someone who needs mental health help,
yes.
right? It's like, oh, you want to be a girl, but you're a boy, or you live under this delusion that you're a girl, but you're clearly a boy. We need to get you help. As a society, we need to look at this and say, oh, we need to get these people help. Like, what do we do about that? But instead, the standards and the pressure is saying, it's like, oh, no, we need to play along. And if you don't play along, you're going to be silenced. You might lose your job.
Yes.
You're definitely going to be kicked off of social media. It's crazy.
I know. Well, on yesterday's program, I believe it was, you mentioned a case in Great Britain where a pastor was actually convicted, and he was sentenced for misgendering.
Misgendering. Yeah, that's a new crime for you.
Right. And people may say, well, gee, that's on the other side of the big pond. That's not the United States of America, but if we keep going in the direction that we're going, we could be there. And we could be there in a not-too-distant future.
Well, I mean, there's aspects of in America that is happening. Fortunately, mm-hmm. we're also seeing a lot of pushback. Another story that we shared yesterday was one that The New American ran on Governor Lee from Tennessee.
Yes.
Signing bills, sane bills, that make it illegal for various practices, hormone therapy, and obviously mutilation and things like that. So we're seeing that struggle, and it all comes back to, it looks like we're finally starting to see some pushback.
Right, but I think making it illegal for minors, right?
Yes, right. Yes. Right. Good point, yeah.
Right.
Because adults, I guess, you know, if that's what they want to do.
Yeah, but there are a lot of things a minor cannot do, for example. A minor cannot drink alcohol, right?
Right.
But supposedly a minor
can change his sex.
And have surgery to remove body parts.
Yeah. It's absolutely insane. Well, right. It looks like we're running down out of time there. But so where do you see this going?
Well, first of all, I think it's by design. I don't think it's happenstance. It's coming down from the top, and I believe, and the New American, with all it's published over the years, has certainly demonstrated with tons of evidence that there is an organized plan, there is a conspiracy, and what they're trying to do, what the insiders are trying to do, is to destroy our civilization, to leave smoldering ruins upon which they can build their new world order.
Well, hopefully we continue to push back, and we are grateful for our viewers and readers, and we'll continue to keep doing the work that we're doing so we can keep helping inform the public so that we can make, the public can make informed and good decisions.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Gary, so much for your time.
Thanks, Paul, for having me.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family. Perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home. But I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Several years ago, I worked with a team of experts and we developed Extractgevity. Extractgevity is an all-natural energy and health supplement. An all-natural energy and health supplement. I take it every day and I have for years. It comes in a powder form, you mix it with water and enjoy. It includes bilberry extract, grapeseed extract, red wine extract, and pine bark extract, along with vitamin C. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Go do your own homework on the benefits of these supplements. And then you can order it at WVWTVstore.com, or you can call 901-468-9357. That's 901-468-9357, or at WVWTVstore.com. I've been taking it every day for years. In fact, a lot of times in the afternoon, I take a glassful because it is that all-natural energy and health supplement. Now, of course, I got to throw out that disclaimer that this product has not been approved or evaluated by the FDA, is not intended to treat, cure, or prevent any disease. But we invite you to check it out at WVWTVstore.com and enjoy Extractgevity, just as I do every day.
The New American's Alex Newman recently interviewed Trump attorney and former investigative reporter Christina Bob, who wrote the new book, Stealing Your Vote, based on her experience in the middle of the election chaos. Bob discusses how Democrats cheated and manipulated the election process, including through the use of lawless decrees issued under the guise of the COVID emergency. Let's watch.
Let's start with the obvious question. The media told us there was no election fraud, and yet here you are saying there was election fraud. Who do we believe and why?
Yeah, it's funny that back in 2020, immediately, you know, on November 3rd, 2020, the media started with this narrative of, oh, there's no evidence of election fraud. This is the most secure election in U.S. history. Joe Biden is the most popular presidential candidate in U.S. history. And then we see, you know, that narrative start to unravel, and they're not really singing that song anymore. I know a lot of the press have tried to move on and labeled it the big lie that anyone, you know, should dare question whether all of the craziness we saw in 2020 was legitimate or not. But we saw some of the same things. There were some improvements, but we saw some of the same problems, Arizona, for example, in 2022. And we didn't hear that same narrative. You know, everybody watched in horror as Arizona took several days to count their ballots. It was a clear repeat of 2020. Carrie Lake was by far the favored candidate. She was up double digits in the polls like days before the election. Katie Hobbs didn't leave her basement. You know, it was a microcosm of the 2020 election, and everyone looks at it kind of side-eyed like, yeah, that doesn't look right. And the media just ignored it. They didn't do the whole, this was the safest election in Arizona's history, and Katie Hobbs is the most popular gubernatorial candidate in Arizona history. They just kind of were like, look at the spy balloon, you know, or like, look at something else. So I think that idea that 2020 was the most secure election in U.S. history and Joe Biden's the most popular presidential candidate and there's no election fraud whatsoever, I don't think people really buy that anymore. I think people don't know what to think of it if they haven't had the chance to kind of see, which is, you know, partially why I wanted to put the book out.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. The media still pretends like the people who don't believe the 2020 election was legit are like some fringe, tiny minority.
Yeah.
They're election deniers, like they're practically Holocaust deniers, and yet the polls consistently show most Americans believe the 2020 election was marred by massive amounts of fraud. Now, your book has been endorsed by, you know, all the big, Donald Trump. There's an introduction by Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, the whole brain trust of the America First movement. And yet we do have a lot of conservatives, for lack of a better term. You see them regularly on like Fox News and stuff. They say, well, we just need to move on. You know, it's over. It's in the past. Let's just focus on 2024. Can we just move on? And if we just move on, is 2024 going to be better?
No, of course we can't just move on. Now, time still goes off forward, right? Like 2024 is just around the corner. And so, yes, we need to be preparing for 2024, but we can't do it ignoring 2020. That's absolutely ridiculous. And the conservatives that want to do that are a large part of the problem. I focus the vast majority of stealing your vote focuses on the problems within the Republican Party and problems that Republicans caused. I mean, there are really great patriots in all of these states that want to make elections transparent. They want to make them free and fair and all of the great things that we want in our elections, yet their greatest opponents are not Democrats. Their greatest opponents come from within their own political party and will sabotage their efforts to make them unfruitful. So while that's very frustrating, the good side of that, or the good news, is that we have enough that we can clean up on our own side, that we can make enough of a difference to have a fair shot at 2024. I think the Republican Party is just as much to blame. I like to say that Democrats cheated and Republicans covered it up. So if we can just, you know, do away with the cover up and actually push forward with some transparency, I think we'll be fine in 2024, but it's going to take all of us doing our part.
Yeah, I want to ask you about some of the legal issues, Christina, because you're obviously an attorney. That's your background. You've worked in law in the military. I mean, you were stationed in Afghanistan and Germany. I mean, you've got an incredible legal career. You know, there were a lot of court cases about this, a lot of lawsuits filed. Some, you know, were even not quite heard by the Supreme Court, but they reached the Supreme Court, like when Texas sued Pennsylvania over these violations of election law. The Supreme Court said, well, that doesn't affect Texas. They don't have standing. What are your thoughts on the legal issues? How much of the election fraud or the election theft happened through legal maneuvering and legal wrangling? And why didn't the courts weigh in and try to untangle this mess?
Well, legally speaking, before the election, most of the procedures, the COVID election procedures, came down through secretaries of state. It wasn't done through the legislature. And it's the legislature that determines the law. They determine how elections are supposed to be managed. So these secretaries of state just said, yeah, we're going to disregard the law and we're just going to do whatever we want because, you know, COVID. and so that was a problem. And the courts just, post-election, the courts really just refused to hear it. There were some proactive cases prior to the election, but for the most part, Republicans weren't really paying attention. We weren't paying attention, and we certainly didn't think that there was going to be the massive level of cheating that we saw in 2020. So, you know, Donald Trump was so popular, certainly it's going to be fine. Looking at it now, we can say, okay, so we see all of these secretaries of state, and I can't even call them all Democrats because Republicans were involved in it too, that just disregarded the law and did whatever they wanted. We need conservatives on the ground to make sure that the procedures are followed appropriately. And if you need to petition in your county or all the way up to your state to make sure that they're actually following their own laws, you know, that's something that we need to do. And then after the election, when you had all of these legitimate challenges come forward, I don't know. I don't know why the courts didn't entertain it. They've never once allowed any of the cases to admit any evidence. You know, the report saying, oh, the courts heard the cases and found that there was no evidence of fraud. That never happened. Nowhere. Not in a single state. Every single case was thrown out on standing, on timing, legal procedural issues, or mootness. So no court heard any of the evidence. So I think we have a pandemic of cowardice in our judiciary. But, you know, I can't speak for them. For 2024, I don't even want it to get to the judiciary, quite frankly. I think if we get enough people involved beforehand, let's make sure our scared little judges don't even need to get involved, right? That we can just have enough people involved in the process that we can secure, make sure the election is secure.
what are some things that can and should be done to make sure we don't have that problem again, to make sure that we can have confidence in our elections going forward?
Yeah, so there's a multi-approach that we can do here that we need to do. Certainly, state legislatures need to be taking a look at their local laws and local rules and see if there's anything that the citizens want to push for a more secure election. You know, we hear a lot about voter ID, paper ballots, one-day voting. You know, all of those types of policies can be implemented if that's something that the people in a certain area want. And if certainly if that's something that you want, if you want to enforce voter ID requirements, or if you want to shorten the amount of time that people have to vote, whatever it is, petition your members of Congress or your state house or your state legislature and let them know what you want, and organize your friends. Let them know what you want the rules to be, what will make you feel secure. So you have the legislative side. And then for the actual operational side, I would say petition your counties and work with your county leadership to decentralize the vote and decentralize the tally. Because the way we had done voting and tallying in the past was everybody votes at their precinct. You know, you go to your neighbor's house in the cul-de-sac down the street and you recognize everybody there. You know them because you've all been in the neighborhood for a while. And it's easy to spot someone who's not supposed to be there, or it's easy to spot things that are out of place. Well, in these large Democrat cities, what they're doing is they're combining everything into centralized facilities and forcing everybody to vote in the same area, one, which makes it less secure because you don't necessarily know who you recognize or who you don't recognize because it's a much bigger area. And two, it's much easier to cheat. If somebody wants to stuff ballots, it's much easier to do that in a large centralized facility as opposed to at the precinct. You know, if I want to drop off an extra 10,000 ballots, I'm not actually exaggerating, maybe not be able to do it all at once, but I've heard reports of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of ballots being added in a single county. You can't add that at one precinct, right? You have to distribute that around the precincts, which means you need a lot more people to cheat. And so when you have these big centralized voting centers and tallying centers, a centralized count, it's much easier to drop off a large number of ballots and nobody noticed. So I think that personally is one of the policies or procedures that I would like to see changed in 2024, is decentralizing the tally and decentralizing the voting.
Yeah, it sounds like a really sensible thing to do and not a difficult thing to do. And you wouldn't think it'd be controversial. I mean, why would anybody who wasn't planning on cheating be opposed to that? Christina, we had a lot in the last couple of years. There was just a flurry of bills filed and new ideas proposed in different states. You know, Florida adopted some things. They created a new office to prosecute election crimes. Are there any policies across the country that really jumped out at you where you said, you know, that is something that every state, or at least every sensible state that isn't planning on cheating, should be working toward?
Well, I think voter ID is very sensible. I think limiting election day to election day, or certainly no more than a week. You know, we've got states where you can vote for 45 days. I mean, that's just ripe for problems. So I'd like to see the time condensed, paper ballots. Paper ballots, machines, all that. There's a number of different security measures that people can put into place. To me, it's more of what do the people in that state want? Because someone in California might have some different ideas than someone in Wyoming, and they each should vote the way that they want to vote based on the rules and the procedures in that area. So I care less about the specific procedures and more about the fact that it's actually the people deciding that. It's the people getting to make sure that their laws are enforced the way that they should be enforced. What I will say, I think Virginia did a fantastic job in 2021 of really learning from 2020, shoring up some of the problems in their election. And that was done, you know, without necessarily a lot of legislation passed. That was the next election after the 2020 election. So they didn't have any legislative or procedural rules changed at all between 2020 and 2021. And yet they still managed to secure their election. And the reason they were able to do that was because the parents were so upset about the Loudoun County school board issues and the transgender and the critical race theory and all of the crazy radical education policies that were being pushed in Virginia schools, that the parents showed up en masse. They worked the polls. They worked the precincts. They were along the entire chain of custody. They had a rapid response team for lawyers. I mean, Virginia really secured their election, and they had a result on election night that turned out to be a conservative victory. So I think... for 2024, I just want to see people get involved however you can and whatever way you can. Make sure you participate.
And before we let you go, I want to ask about the Republican Party. Before we went to break, you mentioned that the Democrats cheated and the Republicans helped cover it up, or at least some of them. Any thoughts on how to deal with this issue within the Republican Party? I know Trump has talked a lot about rhinos and things like this. What are some things that Republicans can do to try to move these people, at least out of the leadership where they're doing all this damage?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So educate yourself on your local area. If you're in an area, whether it's a Republican state or a Democrat state, if you're in a local area where you have a Republican leader in any position, whether it's on a county board of supervisors or commissioners, whether it's election director, whatever it is, if you have someone that's a Republican, put pressure on them to do the right thing and to implement security measures. Because as much as Republicans were in opposition to the Patriots that really wanted to look at the create transparency in the election, what was obvious to me was that these Republicans were very malleable. They had just been molded by Democrats for so long that they were actually doing the bidding of Democrats. So if you have conservative constituents actually voicing their opinion to their elected leaders around the state, within your county, you know, even within the GOP, let them know what you want. Because at the end of the day, they work for us. At the end of the day, the parties are supposed to be supporting us. And the only way they know what they need to do is if we tell them.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
Well, we need just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Next up, two members of the John Birch Society's legislative team warn against replacing the Electoral College with a national popular vote.
This is Peter Eichowski, a research associate with the John Birch Society. I'm joined today by research project manager Christian Gomez, also the John Birch Society. So thank you for being on, Christian.
Thank you for having me on, Peter.
Yeah, so today we'll be talking about the National Popular Vote, also called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which an increasing number of states are passing and implementing. So Christian, what is the National Popular Vote?
Yeah, so when you look at the presidential election, the presidency, the winner of the election, president, vice president, is determined by who gets the majority of the Electoral College, which is the process in which the states have certain number of electoral votes based on the population size of the state, and that determines whoever wins the majority of the Electoral College determines who wins the presidency and vice presidency. Now, the media does also look at who happens to win the what the national popular vote numbers are. And you see those also like on Wikipedia as well, listed on the presidential elections of the past. But the truth is that the national popular vote doesn't determine the winner of the presidency. We live in a republic, not a democracy. So it's not winner take all nationwide. The states get to decide who the president is. So there's this national popular vote interstate compact that was developed shortly after the 2000 election, where Al Gore won the national popular votes. He won more votes than George W. Bush. But George W. Bush won the electoral college votes, so he became the president. And the left has been wanting to move us in the direction away from a republic toward a democracy. So that's how the national popular vote interstate compact came into being.
Yeah, so the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, is that constitutional or does it subvert the U.S. Constitution?
That's an interesting question, because the left argues that technically it is constitutional, and this is their argument. Their argument is, well, actually, first let's kind of backtrack a bit. What actually is the compact itself? So the compact is that certain states band together and they agree that they will collectively, the states that belong to this compact, that they will collectively give all of the electoral votes of their state to whoever wins the national popular vote, regardless of who may have actually won the popular vote within their own state. So, for example, if the state of New York votes overwhelmingly for like a Democrat candidate, which they usually do, but then it so happens that a Republican actually won the national popular vote, like the 2004 election where George W. Bush actually won the popular vote as well as the Electoral College, then if New York is part of this compact, which they actually are part of the compact already, they've agreed to join this in the past, all of New York's electoral votes, instead of going to the Democrat John Kerry or whoever in the future, they would go to the Republican candidate. And the same is true in the reverse. So if a state that voted for the overwhelmingly went for the Republican candidate, if they belong to the compact, all of the state's electoral votes go to the Democrat candidate. And the idea is that they want to have move us in the direction of a democracy. And so that's what the compact is and how the compact would operate. But the compact would go into effect once there is enough states within the compact that comprise at least 270 electoral votes, which is what's needed to win the presidency.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, you asked me whether it's constitutional or not. So in the Constitution, the federal government gives the states the purview and authority to determine how they assign their electoral votes. So right now, if the majority of Wisconsinites vote for, candidate A in an election, then Wisconsin has decided in the past to give the electoral votes of that state over to whoever won the popular vote in the state. They don't have to do that. They can just have the electors. They can just have these electors decide who gets the popular vote. Who wins the electoral votes for the states. In fact, historically, when people vote for the presidency, they're not really voting for the candidate of the president. They're voting for electors to vote for the candidate for the president. So if states choose to give their electoral votes to whoever won the national popular vote, technically an argument can be made that they can do that. But in reality, what this is doing, it is subverting the will and purpose of the Electoral College, because the purpose of the Electoral College is to give the states a role in selecting the president. This throws it out the window and makes the Electoral College, as we know it, a mere shell, where it just reflects the will of the national popular vote, ignoring the states.
Yeah, so the national popular vote is a very dangerous, subversive concept, and we've seen states like California, Illinois, New York, a few other states already pass this. But which states right now are most at risk of enacting this into law?
Glad you asked. So there's two states in particularly that we're really concerned about, Michigan and Minnesota.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so with Michigan, there are bills just introduced, House Bill 4156 and Senate Bill 126.
And if these bills pass, then Michigan would join the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact that already includes, like you mentioned, Illinois, California, New York, Rhode Island, and several other states. So whoever wins the National Popular Vote, if Michigan passes this, their electoral votes would go to that candidate. And then the other state I mentioned, Minnesota, the bills there were House File 642 and Senate File 538. And again, it's the same idea. If the legislature in Minnesota passes that, then come the next presidential, well, whenever there's 270 electoral votes within the compact collectively, so whenever the compact goes into effect, then these states would be giving their electoral votes, not to the winner of their own state's popular vote, which is what they historically have been doing, but rather to whoever wins the national popular vote. So, you know, forget the interests of your own state.
Yeah, so if Minnesota and Michigan pass these proposals, then it'll be a lot closer to the national popular vote, will be a lot closer to coming into effect.
Absolutely. These are some key states of a good chunk of electoral votes that if they're added to the compact, brings them closer to getting to that desired number of states that they need for the compact to go into effect. And when it does, it's going to be a huge leap forward in the direction of democracy. And the presidential election will be determined in the future by whoever wins, basically the large cities. You'll have candidates who will be totally ignoring rural areas and suburban areas. They'll just be campaigning in Chicago, Detroit, St. Paul, Minnesota, Los Angeles, and ignoring what they call flyover country, ignoring whole swaths of the country. So it'll be the big cities choosing who wins the presidency, just like how in some states the big cities determine who becomes the governor.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we need to make sure that Michigan, Minnesota, and every other state stop this proposal. So how can people stop this? What should anyone watching do to put an end to this?
Well, I would say first find out if your state already has this already in place. If it does, contact your legislator and ask them to repeal the state's membership in the compact. But specifically with Michigan and Minnesota, they're not in the compact yet. So if you live in those states, stop it now. So we have two legislative alerts on JBS.org. So if you click on the state alerts, click on either Michigan or Minnesota, depending on which of those two states you might live in, then you'll find the alerts there for opposed Michigan national popular vote or the opposed Minnesota national popular vote. And right there, you can use that alert to send a pre-written editable email message to your legislator and phone call, and even a little video as well, urging them to not pass that bill because it would be destructive to our elections in this country.
Excellent. Yeah, so jbs.org/alerts. And it looks like we're out of time, so we encourage everyone to go to jbs.org/alerts to go there, contact your legislators, tell them to stop the national popular vote and to stand up in favor of the U.S. Constitution.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents a alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
According to Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of Connecticut, Howard Cork Hayden, the contradictions and false predictions made by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change should be glaringly obvious to anyone. The New American's Alex Newman recently interviewed Dr. Hayden at the Heartland Institute's Climate Summit in Orlando. In the interview, Dr. Hayden said the UN is working to reorient the entire world to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Let's watch the interview.
Professor, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You just got off the stage. You were talking about the contradictions of the IPCC, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They produce what's supposedly the Bible of climate science. What kind of contradictions have you found there?
Well, the main contradiction has to do with the difference between the amount of additional radiation that is emitted by the surface and the amount of radiation blockage that can be done by what they call their radiative forcing. And in all cases, they predict temperatures that are too high. They produce too much more radiation than can be accounted for by their greenhouse gases. It's simply, they just propose things that are physically impossible. And all they have to do is to apply the Stefan-Boltzmann radiation law that has been with us since about 1860 to their predicted temperature results, and they don't do it.
Why don't they do it?
I give up. Why?
Interesting.
Perhaps it's oversight. Perhaps it's they don't want to contradict their political bosses because there's big money involved. I don't know. I mean, make up your own rules. I'm not a mind reader.
So, there are a lot of scientists who are retired, like yourself, who are no longer teaching, no longer dependent on, university or grant funding, who are speaking out. But among those who are in university still, there seems to be very few scientists who will publicly talk about these issues that people like yourself are raising. What do you suppose is going on?
Well, I don't really know, but one thing I have noticed is an over-reliance on people who are allegedly experts. In other words, if somebody has some kind of theory about biology or something like that, I'm not going to contradict him because I'm not an expert in biology. And so if somebody is an expert in, let's say, nuclear physics, is he going to contradict somebody who is an expert in climate science? It's very often that sort of thing. Let's just call it a respect for people who are in fields other than your own. And it's not necessarily malicious or anything like that. It's just kind of what people do.
So from a broader perspective, the whole hypothesis and the conclusions of the UN IPCC that it's almost certain that the warming is caused by human activity, that CO2 emissions are the primary driver of this. What do you think about that? Is that correct? Are human emissions of CO2 leading us toward a climate crisis that should be solved with these kinds of intergovernmental mechanisms they're proposing?
No. Now, let me explain. If we take the standard thing that the IPCC likes to calculate is what would happen to the temperature if the CO2 rises to twice its present value. And if the CO2 rises to its present value, and I use the IPCC numbers, that would increase the ability of the atmosphere to retain an additional 3.7 watts per square meter from going into space. However, the temperature that they predict for that is around 3 degrees, or between 2 and 5, but we'll just take their 3. That 3 would cause the surface to increase its radiation by 16.7 watts per square meter, which is far in excess of what the CO2 is able to retain. And they just do not apply the Stefan-Boltzmann law to their results.
So in the summary for policymakers, which is used, of course, by policymakers all over the world, they've argued that it's practically a sure thing that CO2 is driving this, and that to fix it, we're going to need massive changes in the economy. I just got back from Egypt a couple months ago. They agreed in their final document that we needed a total restructuring of the planet's energy systems. Now, you work now in this energy field. You edit The Energy Advocate. What are your thoughts on this proposed restructuring of the global energy infrastructure? Does that make sense?
Well, no, you're trying to reorient the entire world to solve a non-existent problem. Why do that kind of malice to humanity in order to solve a problem that does not exist?
Well, I mean, billions, maybe trillions of dollars now are being spent on this, and you're saying the problem doesn't exist. How do we bring humanity back to its senses if that's the case?
It's hard to say. I don't really know. But there's the scientists have the smallest say in this, and the politicians have a heck of a lot more. And I think it's really the press that's got to be changed. After all, the politicians live at the behest of the press. They're held at ransom. The only thing I can say with certain is that the physics that the IPCC is doing is self-contradictory. And that should be enough. It should satisfy scientists. But how do you get through to politicians? How do you get through to press? You look at the expression climate crisis comes up hundreds of millions of times. And climate catastrophe, these expressions get around, and they're just spread around like, who knows? It's just horrid what happens.
Yep. At the last UN conference I went to, we're headed to climate hell, is what the head of the UN and Joe Biden both said. Professor, before we let you go, how do people follow your publication, The Energy Advocate? What's the best place to find it, and how do people sign up if they would like?
Well, I have a website that I don't do much with, but it's a way of communicating with me, called theenergyadvocate.com. I have a few books that are for sale there, but you can also just subscribe, and you can pay for it in PayPal or send a check, or send me email at Cork Hayden, CORKHAYDEN, at Comcast.net.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The New American TV. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.